to you. We should note that Justice Frydenberg is recused in this matter, and we've recused in the rest of the cases for today. With that, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel for the State, may it please the Court. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent the matter Philip Privet. This is an appeal from a summary denial of a post-motion in Knox County. Yes, Knox County District Court. So we've got a few things here. It's really two major issues that we're asking the Court to look at. I might focus on the first assignment of error. And I think the best way to perhaps frame this is how I did it in my brief. The ultimate factual question in a case, talking about post-conviction motion, whether trial counsel fully advised the defendant of all the available options and consequences as both have been entered no an amended information, second-degree murder, firearm. Now, so again, what we're trying to figure out here, the Court's duty is to figure out, is whether got the benefit of full investigation advice based on that investigation in circumstance. One quote that I'd like to point out to the Court is in my brief. I think it's telling. And it actually came in the sentencing hearing. But obviously, the District Court and your Honors have the right to take a look at that, what happened in the sentencing hearing, relate back to maybe what happened prior to the date. At the sentencing hearing, you had trial counsel say that Privet would need to, quote, take responsibility, end quote, for his wife's death, quote, regardless of what happened that caused the death of his wife. These are the words used by trial counsel during sentencing. And I think they're telling. I think they relate back the advice that Mr. Privet alleges he was given by his trial counsel in entering those tests. Now,
isn't acceptance of responsibility a factor that a sentencing judge considers?
Yes, Your Honor.
So wasn't that really an argument in mitigation of punishment?
Your Honor, I believe that's open to record and all the sounding that.
They're at sentencing at that point.
Yes, they are.
Not the case where a trial counsel throws his client under the bus in front of the jury.
Sure.
That's not that this fact.
Okay. We don't want necessarily our trial counsels doing that. And what I would suggest that in addition to this comment, you have other comments, both by trial counsel and by Privet, suggesting that there's more to it, perhaps what Your Honor is suggesting. For instance, if you look at a comment made by Mr. Privet during sentencing, and this is one that the state itself quotes. District Court brought up the expert report of the psychiatrist, Dr. Morris. Mr. Privet actually asked the court that it not be read again, saying that it was not true. That's the crux of Mr. Privet's argument here, that essentially he determined to be competent, not only competent, but also able to form the intent by a psychiatrist that perhaps wasn't evaluating him solely for the purpose of determining his ability to form intent, but was actually evaluating him based on whether he had an opinion that he had a good insanity defense.
So,
two different things.
So let's fast forward to the bottom line here is the argument is there should have been a defense forensic psychologist, right?
That, yes, Your Honor.
And in the motion, is there any allegation about what a defense forensic psychologist would have said?
Your Honor, I believe there is an allegation as to what, as his defense be.
Well, but that's not what I asked. What I asked is there an allegation of what a defense forensic psychologist would have testified to?
That Mr. Privett, yes, Your Honor, Mr. Privett was incapable of forming the level of intent.
But you didn't identify, the motion doesn't identify any forensic psychologist, right?
Mr. Privett has not yet obtained forensic psychologist. Squares with that defense.
Are you suggesting that our case law on this is or should be any different than a motion for post-conviction relief, which asserts that there are witnesses that would testify to something, but doesn't identify witnesses and doesn't say what they would say?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is that every case is different, of course. And, you know, the unique circumstances of Mr. Privett's case are such that if you review, for instance, the parts of the record that I've quoted, as well as certain aspects of our post-conviction motion, which allege that he was unable to form that requisite. That's enough to raise the question of fact as to whether Mr. Privett did have a viable defense that he was not properly advised. You're talking about witnesses located or would have said X, Y, or Z. Ultimately, that different in a way, because we can speculate as to what any witness might say. But
can't we speculate about what some forensic psychologist might say? I'm not seeing a distinction there. The implicit assumption is there's some psychologist out there somewhere who would say this, but the motion doesn't allege who it is or specifically what they would say. On that, we would agree, right? It doesn't say that.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what Mr. Privett alleges in his post-conviction motion is not necessarily exactly what a psychiatrist would say. What he alleges in his motion is a mental condition he was suffering at the time of the offense. Alleged offense. That's where it's a little different than a lay witness. For instance, that an eyewitness or alleged...
What's your best case authority to support the proposition presenting today? That somehow you don't, in a post-conviction motion, have to identify the expert and state what they would say.
Your Honor, what I refer back to when I make these arguments here, the allegation... baseline case law that we have to provide an allegation of fact that's not conclusory or merely mere factor law. Now, what we have done, I believe, is gotten enough in this question of whether Mr. Privett fully advised of options available to. That's the ultimate question. Not necessarily what exactly expert psychiatry would say about Mr. Privett. This stage, allege that allegations sufficient to support our claim that Mr. Privett was not fully advised and that his attorney didn't fully investigate all aspects of. So I'm getting a little further into the stratosphere. You're in a little further, obviously, than parses with my argument. I'd like the court to look at this from a broader perspective. Ultimately, if you can't Mr. Privet is held to a standard of proving exactly what a psychiatrist would say at this stage. Court's asking him to provide expert opinion that, you know, may not be able to have an evidentiary hearing that gives us the opportunity to ask actual questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
Please the court. Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Appellant argues the district court urged in denying his motion at an evidentiary hearing. In that motion, he raised two claims of effective assistance of trial counsel. One, based on trial counsel's alleged failure to investigate his mental health issues and how it affected him the night of the crime. And the other, that counsel allegedly failed to ensure that he could hear the proceedings during the plea hearing. The state believes the district court correctly dismissed this motion without an evidentiary hearing, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. I will begin by addressing the claim that this court discussed with the appellant about his mental health and the medication issues. The claim he presented was that his PTSD and his medications caused him to enter a dissociative state at the time of the offenses, that it eliminated his ability to form the requisite intent, and that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to adequately investigate this. First, appellant's motions makes only conclusions of fact. He provides no information about why the evaluations that were completed were not reliable. Additional information would have changed the outcome if an additional evaluation had been completed, what expert should have been consulted for that additional evaluation, and how this expert would have arrived at a different conclusion than the evaluation that actually was performed.
Does a defendant in a post-conviction action situation like this have to actually name the expert?
Well, Your Honor, this court in other cases has required a certain degree of specificity in, as Justice Castle pointed out, situations where a defendant is alleging that a witness was not called. This court has typically, in the case of witnesses not called, required the names or some more detailed descriptions of the testimony that was provided. I can't recall off the top of my head if this court has specifically noted in a case of an expert being called, but I do know that generally when witnesses are alleged to not have been called, this court has found that if a witness's name has not been provided or some description of their testimony, not a sufficiently raised allegation.
Well, in this situation, even if there had been a name given, have to have been an evaluation done in advance to know that this is what the expert's going to testify to warrant the evidentiary hearing?
I'm not sure exactly how much detail we need to be provided. I think in this case, there's a big gap. The allegation is, I have PTSD and was on medication, therefore I couldn't form the necessary intent. I think that even suppose that an evaluation had not been done, but if the appellant had provided some information about perhaps common symptoms of PTSD and maybe mechanisms or the, as I previously mentioned, maybe he was going to say, well, typically when you evaluate people with PTSD, you should perform these types of evaluations. They weren't done on my initial evaluation, so we think that the results are different. I don't know. I think it's very fact specific. I think here that even if the expert had been named, I still don't think that we've still got that big gap here where we don't have any information about why what was done previously was wrong and so why something done now was different. And I think that is a big failing for this. I think that's a big leap to ask, a big gap.
So Justice Funk, part of his question was, could the defendant required to have an examination done before claiming there's somebody out there who could have changed the results here?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I can give a broad answer to that question. I apologize. I know that's not very satisfactory for this court. I think that in this case, had an expert name been provided, but the evaluation not been completed, if perhaps then appellant had provided information about the new types of evaluations that would have been available or the types that should have been performed but were not and could show that this expert will perform those, and we think, based on applicable research or the facts and circumstances that were not presented to the original evaluator, that these will result, a reasonable probability, well, I don't know that I want to say reasonable probability, but that they would result in different finding. I think it's going to be fact-specific. I think that in some cases, yes, maybe an appellant would need to have found that expert and to have gotten that evaluation, in particular in the case of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, because this court has previously stated that when an effective claim based on a failure to advise of a defense, so if in this case it's a defense appellant is arguing he was not advised of, that the prejudice prong is resolved by it looks at would that defense have been successful at trial. So I think that in the case of an ineffective claim, say, I should have had this defense, and he has to, we could resolve this matter if we know that the defense would not have been successful at trial. So in that case, this court may find that an evaluation would need to be.
In the ineffective counsel pleading situation, have we not distinguished between raising that on direct appeal and in the post-conviction setting? Adequacy of pleading.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I understand your question. I apologize.
She's asking, you have to plead prejudice.
Oh, correct, Your Honor.
In post-conviction.
In post-conviction, yes.
Whereas if you're raising ineffective counsel on your direct appeal.
You do not have
you
to.
You just identify deficiency.
Correct, Your Honor.
Are you in agreement, Jeff?
Yeah, I think we're there. The question I was going to ask, assume you had a post-conviction motion that says Dr. Moore did an evaluation, Dr. So-and-so has reviewed Dr. Moore's evaluation, here are potential deficiencies that we think could lead to admissible evidence. That gets there, probably, right?
I think depending on the situation, yes, because then we wouldn't have this big leap to make that we have in this case.
So you don't necessarily have to have an evaluation, but you got to have somebody who's prepared to say there's something, there's some there.
Correct, Your Honor, and I think that's why here we don't have any, the only problem, I guess, with the evaluation that was completed was that it was not favorable to the defendant, to the appellant, and I don't think that that is a sufficient standard to show that counsel performed efficiently for failing to get a second, a third, a fourth, however many opinions it would take to find an evaluation that would be favorable to him. So I think in this case, as noted, that appellant offers only conclusory allegations, but even if he had made some more specific allegations, record shows that his mental health was evaluated. Appellant was evaluated twice, the first to determine if he was competent to stand trial, the second after he filed a motion to rely on an insanity defense. And Dr. Moore did perform the evaluations here and noted that while appellant had been treated PTSD, the symptoms appeared to be anxiety and some sleep problems, and the doctor found no evidence that appellant's PTSD would have not allowed him to understand what during at the time of the incident. He did not find evidence of any mental disorder that would do the same. Very briefly, appellant's second claim related to his ability to plea proceedings. The statements that he points to that show that he argues show he was unable to hear actually occurred at the sentencing hearing. There was no indication at the plea hearing given that he was unable to hear or understand the proceedings that were occurring, and the state believes that the district court correctly denied that claim by the record. If there are no additional questions, we ask you to affirm.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day, then, is State versus Ebert.